Thank you for joining today's episode of Your Double Podcast. My name is Danielle Dauda, and I'll be speaking today with John Sikki. John is an American national with two children who were abducted to South Korea from San Francisco. And even though South Korea is a Hague Convention signatory country, John has been unable to reunite with his children. And so he's undertaken a treadmill protest in Korea to spread awareness about his case and the general situation of parental abduction in Korea. Today, I'll be speaking with John about his experience, his protest, and the general situation in Korea when it comes to parental abduction and alienation. So much for joining us today, John. I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us a bit more about your story and the protest you're doing right now in Korea. Can you just give us a bit of background about your case, your family, etc.?
Sure. Yes. Thank you for hosting me and helping me get the story out. So I have two children, a son and a daughter, in my current marriage, and they were abducted from our home in San Francisco at the end of 2019 to Korea, which is the home country of their mother. And we're still married legally. The divorce is a complicated thing in its own right. So I'll just refer to her as either their mother or my wife. So it's been 3 years now that the abduction has been going on. And I've spent most of that time in Korea trying to get the case resolved and get my kids back home to San Francisco. So that's the kind of very high level picture.
Thank you for sharing that. And I know that currently you've been engaging in some sort of protest in Korea. Can you tell us a bit more about that, why you're doing it, and what has the experience been so far?
Yes, sure. So starting in October of 2022, which is last year, I began this protest. I called it the treadmill protest because the court orders to return the children to San Francisco were not being enforced by the Korean authorities. Basically, no government official has done anything of any meaning to enforce them. So as a result, I wanted to get the message out to people about the problem with the way the enforcement works right now or doesn't work right now in Korea. So the basic premise of the protest was I set up a manual powered treadmill on the street or in parks or various places around Seoul. It's actually a mobile protest, so I could drive the treadmill around and just set it up almost anywhere. And then just started walking. And I had some cutouts of my children's basically life size in front of me with a gap between me and my children. So the visual metaphor worked pretty well. People would stop and look and be curious what's going on here. And they could see I'm doing something over and over, but I'm not getting any closer to the children. So even though I don't speak Korean, that was a good way to communicate the situation visually. And I printed out a lot of flyers explaining the basics of the situation and set up a website. And then I have an interpreter who helps me explain the situation in Korean when people stop at the protest. And sometimes she's not there. I just try to speak very, very simple Korean to explain the situation. So yeah, that's the basics of what the protest was. And the main goal of the protest was to get attention on the problem. And obviously the media, traditional media and social media are the best way to do that. And that turned out to be very successful so far, actually surprisingly successful. When I first set up the treadmill the very first day, I was afraid people were just going to laugh at me or ignore me or just walk on by. And that's not what happened. Many people stopped to try to understand, to ask me questions, to give their advice and opinions. And eventually, random people who had connections in the media started actually helping get the story out. It started with some small ones, and then mid-November, we got a big broadcaster, SBS, one of the main broadcasters in Korea, who picked up the story and basically followed me around for a week, trying to see the children, going to the police to try to, you know, find out what was going on and those kinds of things. And they did a really good job of explaining the situation in a way that average Korean people could understand very well. So that was pretty amazing. And then from there, it got picked up by quite a few newspapers and other like smaller YouTube channels. We've got another big YouTube program coming out probably end of January. So the momentum's been really good so far. So that's the main points of how the protest has gone.
That's amazing. So it seems like the protest has really allowed you to get your story and just kind of the general information about the problems surrounding parental alienation abduction in Korea into the media and then ideally into the public domain.
Yeah, that's right. So, and the first step has been within Korea itself. We have not yet got it into much of the international media or the US media yet. So I'll be working on that next. And it started out all in Korean language programs. Then we did get some English language newspaper write-ups on it inside of Korea. So again, next step would be to get out to the wider world.
That's amazing. And I wonder, as you're doing these protests, have people kind of come to visit you who've been affected and perhaps they didn't know they were affected, and when they saw you doing what you're doing, something clicked, or, you know, they wanted support, would that be, you know, adults who were abducted or alienated as children or parents who were in a similar situation to yours?
Yes, I was actually surprised by that part. There were two main connections that happened there. And yes, one was for children of divorce. And I had quite a few cases where people would watch, read the flyers, ask me some questions, and then share their story about how their parents got divorced and they were almost implicitly cut off from one of their parents. And it had created great trauma and sadness in their life. And so when they saw the protest, especially with the cutouts of my children, they immediately identified with my children. So that resonated very strongly. I had not expected that because I'm coming at it from the parents' perspective. And so that was a surprise and then a very welcome one in the sense of, I felt a lot of empathy on the overall situation because even the younger generation was picking up on it, not just my generation. So that was the first connection that happened. And then the second connection that happened was after the SBS broadcast on Korean TV, a group of parents inside of Korea, which fights against parental alienation, reached out to me and basically invited me to their meetings, helped support me. One of them actually, you know, printed out free business cards with the story on it and those that I could hand out as well. And then the reason that that connection worked very well has to do with the details of the problems with enforcement in Korea, which I can get into, I think, in the next section a little more. But long story short, when parents in Korea want to stop the other parent from seeing their children for whatever reason, parental alienation is a very common tactic used. And parental alienation is also a tactic used in order to defeat Hague return orders inside of Korea. So that's why that connection happened.
And what are your future plans for the protest?
Yeah, so actually, I've been at it for 4 months now, and we're in the middle of winter. So I actually need to recharge a little bit. It's been really, really powerful and empowering, actually, but it's also been very draining. I'm an introvert, so doing this protest was actually a huge challenge for me, personality-wise. I would have a lot of social anxiety every morning before going out and still do a little bit. So that was also very draining once it got over to the media side and doing a lot of interviews and that kind of activity. But I'm going to take a little break, go back home to San Francisco, my home, and visit with friends and family a bit, try to recharge and map out the next stage of the protest and maybe make some changes to it. Bring in some new ideas. I'm trying to be creative on that. And again, focus on the international media aspect as well.
Awesome. So if any of our listeners, whether they be parents or just interested individuals, want to support you, like what kind of support do you need, whether that be, you know, inside Korea or even people who live outside of Korea?
Yeah. So actually, the first level of support that I already got a lot from the protest, which was very surprising, was just the number of people who offered words of encouragement on the street at the protest. And in Korean, it's usually either "화이팅," which is what they say at sports games for like, you know, cheering your team on, or "힘내세요" means, you know, stay strong, you can do it, kind of expression. And then on social media, especially after I set up an Instagram for the protest, and a lot of people flowed into that from traditional media after seeing the story and added me as a follower, started following me. And the exact same thing, so many people sent me individual messages of encouragement and sharing some of their stories and that kind of thing. That was actually really heartwarming. It really made me feel like, wow, I'm not doing this alone. There's a lot of people who care and really want to do it. So no matter what, that's like a really nice baseline level of support. And then as far as practical things, obviously, if you do have connections in media or have a friend who has a connection to media, something like that, sharing the story is always super helpful. Number two, we'll be creating some petitions. There's another father who's Korean American who's in the same situation. So we'll create one petition for the Korean National Assembly. And that, I think that petition will only be signable by either Korean nationals or foreign residents inside of Korea. You have to have at least like a Korean phone number. And then I'll create a separate petition for probably whitehouse.gov or change.org. I haven't actually mapped it out yet. So we'll have basically one Korean targeted one and one international or US targeted one. So that, I think that will be the second main way beyond just media contacts. And then if anyone listening has, you know, connections in government, obviously Congress or State Department, or know about a hearing coming up that they'll be inviting Left Behind parents to or something like that, I think that would be super helpful as well to connect me on that.
Great. And we'll go ahead and put a link to your website in this description. And if you want to share like an email address or some way people can get in contact with you if they can support, we can do that as well.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, I'll give you the email address.
Awesome. So it seems like the protest has, you know, done wonders to spread awareness. I'm going to assume in a country where this is something that's not talked about a lot, something that's probably very stigmatized, and also get into the media. Has it made any change or progress when it comes to government's response, whether that be from the Korean officials or the Americans?
There hasn't been a specific response, but we do know that the attention from the media is making more pressure internally inside of Korea to change some things. So we're waiting to hear, I think, good news from the talks that are going on between the State Department and Korea right now. But the way I understand it, it's fairly implicit. There's no explicit kind of agreement or something like that. But the State Department themselves don't like to speak out directly against a foreign country, particularly an ally like Korea, unless it's a very, like, there's no other way to get the message through. So I think when the Left Behind parent gets a media channel of their own, the State Department, my understanding is, wants to try to use that as a way to get the message through as a side channel, basically. For example, I had some meetings with Michelle Bernier-Tok, who's the special advisor on children's issues, who came to Korea in December to meet with government officials, Supreme Court here, the Ministry of Justice, Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And at that time, reporters were talking to me. And so they knew that meeting was happening. And so after the meeting that I had with Ms. Bernier-Tok, I passed on some of the information that she had told me. And so I think that's one way that having that media channel open then gets more progress going, because of course the Korean government officials see that in the newspaper and everything else and know that the people who care about the situation are watching, and people with some power in the situation as well.
That's great. I know, yeah, it's going to be much slower, unfortunately, progress when it comes to government, because there's, you know, sometimes laws that need to be changed, and there's just such deeply embedded practices, standards, etc. But it's good to always hold them accountable and make sure that they're, you know, we're putting the pressure on them in the public sphere.
Yes, likewise on the State Department side, that's why I think the international media attention will be important, because getting more push, not just directly on the Korean side, but push on to the State Department from the international media and from Congress is also necessary sometimes to eliminate these roadblocks. I should mention, separate from the government side, the media attention also had some quite direct effects on my individual case itself. So what happened was, after we did the SBS broadcast, and there was a huge number of views on YouTube for that broadcast and comments about it. Afterwards, SBS reached, there was some connections that happened between SBS and the extended family of the children's mother. And SBS actually tried to do a follow-up where I would be able to meet the children for Christmas or something like that. So that didn't actually work. There was too much resistance from mom. But I did get to have a phone call with the kids on Christmas. It was a very, very limited, constrained phone call, but I was able to tell them, Merry Christmas, I love you, I miss you. And so that was actually a little mini breakthrough that would not have happened without the media attention. So that again was not a miracle, but it was like, wow, media is really powerful.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because yes, I mean, obviously the change can happen from like high level where, you know, enforcement takes place and, you know, whether that's return or visitation, but it can also be, like you said, from extended family, from coworkers, whoever it be, that can put pressure on the abducting parent to do what's right. And I think we can't underestimate also the power of that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I will say the media in Korea is very powerful. And I by watching how it works, I could see even the sort of very slow and bureaucratic pieces of the government. The media is almost like a fourth branch of government, the way it should be, that makes things happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. So it's a really important component of the democracy here.
I speak with a lot of left behind parents, and you know, some of them have been separated from their children for 5 years, decade, and you know, they get to the point where they want to do something different, because I mean, how much can you email back and forth to the State Department, reach out to your local politicians, et cetera, to try and get resolution on your case? How many times can you go to Congress and testify? And a lot of them come to me with ideas of doing similar protests, something that would get a media attention, that would spread awareness. Sometimes it's not always an option for all. But I mean, what would be your advice? Like, what was it that made you decide, like, this treadmill protest is something I want to do? What would be your advice to a parent that's considering doing something similar, whether in any country? How can they get started?
That's a very good question. I went through a lot of thinking before undertaking this and talking to different people and getting their advice, because I had actually been inspired originally by the hunger strikes that were carried out in Japan the last year or so. And for me, that was a little bit extreme. I wasn't ready to go that far. You know, I want to stay healthy and be able to hopefully enjoy time with my children one day. But still, the basic fortitude that goes into something like that was very inspiring. So I tried to think of something sustainable that I could do without risking my health or something like that. So I think just getting out and doing something is always better than nothing. But you do have to be very careful about perception. And that's where I got a lot of feedback at first. And I think doing an in-country protest is probably the most effective. It might be the most dangerous sometimes, but it's also the most effective, because then you're getting as close to the source of the problem as possible. So I think if anybody who would want to undertake something like this would be well advised to talk to people from that country and get their opinion about what would work, what would look foolish, what would look, you know, threatening, what would look like attacks on their country, and try to avoid all those kinds of mistakes, and then come up with something positive that will resonate well with people who see it. So interestingly, when I described the treadmill setup to different people, when I talked to Korean people, they got it immediately, and they were like, yeah, this is a good idea. You should do this. Whereas when I talk to American people, they're like, ah, that's kind of silly. People are just going to think you're, you know, crazy or something like that. So luckily I listened to the Korean people. but even within Korea, I got different opinions. Some people were like, yeah, this is good. Other people were like, no, you need to be loud and in people's faces with a bullhorn, because that's how most people actually do it in Korea. And that was another case where I just listened to my own instincts and went with what works well for my personality, which is, again, not an extrovert and not into really kind of pushing to people, more kind of pulling, saying, hey, here I am, please help me. So I know that answer is kind of all over the map, but I think, yeah, creativity is probably the most important thing going into it. Just brainstorm different ideas and then get really good feedback to craft the message and the approach.
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. I want to move to the situation in Korea a bit. So I don't think we've covered Korea in too much detail on our podcast before. We've covered countries such as Japan. Korea, if I'm not mistaken, is a signatory of the Hague Convention, correct?
Yes, it is, since like 2012.
Okay. And your children were obviously internationally abducted, you said, from the US to Korea.
That's right.
So why haven't your children been returned? What's stopping them from being returned to the country they were abducted from?
Yeah. So the first part is just overall delays. That's a huge problem with the Korean implementation of the Hague Convention. The guidance is supposed to be, you know, cases are supposed to be handled very quickly, typically within like 6 weeks, or at least the country has to explain why it's taking longer than 6 weeks. From when the application is filed. Korea doesn't honor that at all. It's just not interested in treating these cases with urgency. So that's what lets the case drag out over years. Korea, so far, from my experience, the court decisions were all very good. They all followed the Hague very carefully. And so that was very encouraging that the judges got the purpose of the Hague Convention and everything that goes with it. The main reason that my children are not back to San Francisco is that even after all appeals have been exhausted, the return decision has been finalized for almost a year now by the Korean Supreme Court decision, there's basically no meaningful enforcement of return decisions. And that's at almost every level. And I can go through that, what that means. In practice, there's two main branches of enforcement. First of all, the police don't get involved in enforcement at all. It's treated purely as a civil matter and treated by the court enforcement officers. So enforcement can be either direct enforcement, which means actually going to where the children are and picking them up and taking them home, or it can be indirect enforcement. So I'll start with the problems with direct enforcement. The procedure used for direct enforcement, there's no child psychologist or social worker or police or anything like that. There's just a court enforcement officer. They call him the jipengwon in Korean. It's basically like a bailiff in English. So I'll say the bailiff and the left behind parent lawyer, some witnesses, go to where the children are to attempt the enforcement. Now, regardless of whether the court decision has said, hey, the children should not have a say in this decision, the bailiff still asks the children for their opinion about what should happen. So, for example, in my Hague return decision, it clearly states the children are way too young. At the time of the enforcement, my daughter was 3 and my son was 5, to be making any sort of decisions about this case. That's what the judges say, but the court enforcement officer follows his or her own procedure. And that procedure starts by evaluating whether the children are competent to make the decision themselves, and if so, then asking the children whether they want to go with the left behind parent or not. And if the children say no, they don't want to go, that's the end of the enforcement. The enforcement fails. nothing more happens. So that's what happened in my case. In very young children, the judge has already said they should not be making any decision like this. The bailiff asked them questions to make sure that they can speak Korean. So he asked them their names and ages. Where do you go to school? What class are you in? Do you like playing with your brother? Those were the questions he asked them. And once they were able to answer those questions successfully, he considered them competent to be deciding their own fates and putting this enormous burden on them to choose between mom and dad. So from a Western, or maybe I should say a US perspective, at least, that's child abuse. So having to witness that was very painful. And my daughter is actually, even at 3 years old at that time, very, very emotionally intelligent. When asked the question, she said, well, if I go with dad, then how will I see mom? So then the bailiff took that as, yeah, no, I want to stay with mom. So it's very difficult to talk about that scene. Just the absurdity of the situation, especially given the fact that California, where they came from, is a joint custody state. By default, both parents should share custody, and the courts in California do everything they can to keep both parents in the children's lives. But instead, everything's being done from a Korean perspective, where typically after divorce, children go with one parent, and the other parent has very limited or no access to the children for the rest of their childhoods. And so that process of asking that question doesn't even make sense. There's no reason to have to choose between mom and dad. Everyone should go back to California and work things out in court there, because that's what the Hague Convention was set up to do, to make sure that the jurisdiction stays in the home country if a return is going to happen. So we covered direct enforcement, and then the other main route is called indirect enforcement. So there are a couple different ways to do that one, but the primary indirect enforcement mechanism is something very much like contempt of court in other countries, except without any of the quasi-criminal stuff that happens with contempt of court in the US, for example. It's a purely civil contempt of court. So that way that works, and again, this is a super dragged out process that takes many months at each step, serving the taking parent over and over and this kind of stuff for just ridiculous delays. But it starts with a performance order. The judge says, by a certain date, please, make arrangements to return the children yourself. If you don't do that, then there'll be a fine imposed. And then if you don't pay the fine, then in theory, there's supposed to be a detention up to 30 days. So we went through that whole process with the performance order and then the fine being imposed. The fine ended up being something like about $4,000 equivalent US dollars. And so after the fine was paid, and then there was this whole other round for detention, what happened in my case was the children's mother just didn't show up at court for any of that. So she had to be served through public notice. And so that finally went through. And then the judge went ahead and imposed the maximum penalty of 30 days detention, which again, it's not a punishment, because this is a civil case. It's a coercive mechanism to try to persuade the taking parent, hey, please comply with this court order. But she wasn't there at court. If she had been there at court, then the detention would actually take place immediately if she had actually argued and then been rejected, had her argument rejected. So instead, at that point, in theory, the police are supposed to enforce the detention, but the police don't actually do anything. The most they'll do is go to the last known address for the taking parent, and if she answers the door, then they would actually execute the detention order. So of course, the taking parent just goes and hides somewhere else, and the detention order expires after 6 months. So we're currently in the middle of that. I'm doing everything I can to actually try to get the police to do something, but I don't have a lot of high expectation that that's actually going to happen. So the problem is not just direct enforcement. It's even the indirect enforcement mechanism. The person who's not following the law can almost just laugh at it and not go on with their lives. Other if you have to hide out from the police and stuff, your life is disrupted. But the pressure is just too weak to actually resolve the situation. There's one more indirect enforcement mechanism, which is a kind of a daily debt that accrues. So you could order, for example, say every day that you don't return the children, the court's gonna fine you an extra $100 or something like that. And then that accumulates as time passes. In this case, the judge still hasn't even ordered that, mechanism either, because he was afraid that it would set a precedent in other cases because they've never done it before and blah, blah, blah. So in the end, there's just been no enforcement of any kind except for the fine. The system is just broken.
Well, in theory, it also, if they're not enforcing anything, even if they implement a fine, are they going to actually make sure she pays it? I mean, again, it comes to enforcement, right?
Yeah, apparently the fine is something, it's like a glorified parking ticket or something like that. So you could probably continue to live without even paying the fine.
So what is the solution then? What is needed then from Korea, Korean authorities, law enforcement? What has to change so that people are not able to internationally abduct their children to Korea and basically just get away with it?
Yeah, I think there's high level answers to that and low level answers to that. The high level answers, I think someone needs to actually be responsible and accountable. I think at this point, there's no one in government who is held accountable for whether returns actually happen or not. In theory, that should be the Ministry of Justice, which acts as Korea's central authority. But the Ministry of Justice hasn't been granted any of the necessary powers to actually tell other government agencies to do anything. So it's more like a central observer instead. So my real belief is unless the U.S. puts enough pressure to actually get that sort of high-level whole of government change, it's probably going to continue to stay in this really, really broken situation. At the lower levels, there's specific things that need to change. So obviously the first one is that rule used for direct enforcement, the procedure. And that can be changed either through new laws, which takes a while, or that can be changed through direct updates to the regulations that are set by the Korean Supreme Court for how the bailiffs carry out the execution. So there is talk about both of those going on. And that's what some of the discussions between the State Department and the Korean side are about, can we make some quick changes to the Supreme Court rules so that we can get these court orders enforced and get the bailiffs to actually do the job? And then again, that should also go along with having social workers and child psychologists involved to make sure the children are protected throughout that process so that they're told what's going on at each step so they can understand what's happening and try to minimize the trauma from getting all the way back home. And that's super important as well. I think all of the other pieces, the indirect enforcement also needs to change. So the police need to be given the powers to go off and actually execute it. And again, someone needs to be telling them to do that. And then finally, there's the criminal aspects. So treating everything as purely civil seems like it's just not working. Now, the Hague Convention is a civil remedy, but there's no reason that it can't be backed up with teeth from the criminal side. So that could be either by making parental kidnapping a crime in more cases. It's a crime in some cases in Korea, but it's a very gray area. That could be one way to handle it. And then the other way would be, right now in Korea, if you are a deadbeat parent, if you don't pay child support, it's a very similar situation to Hague returns in terms of the kind of, you know, the fine and the detention. And on the civil side, they have some other penalties, like they'll take away your driver's license, they might put an exit ban on you, and they even have like a wall of shame on the web of all the deadbeat parents that they've started using as a way to pressure people. But finally, at the end, if still another year goes by and your child support bills have gone over a certain amount that you haven't paid, then they criminalize it. So there's no reason that couldn't also be done for Hague return cases as well.
Interesting. And I think this takes us then to the domestic situation. So, I mean, obviously your case is international. International cases tend to get the most media exposure. But the reality is that, you know, abduction usually happens in larger numbers domestically. It's usually a bigger domestic problem. So that would be within Korea and could be two foreigners, a foreigner and a Korean, or two Koreans, you know, abducting the child within Korea. And then I think that is very much linked to their response to people who refuse to pay child support. And the question being, you know, are those parents, do they even have access to their children? So I guess my question to you is, like, how much do you know about the domestic situation of abduction in Korea? Is it a problem? How widespread of a problem is?
Yes, I don't know with certainty. I've heard a lot of anecdotal stories, and I'm learning more through the parental alienation group. But I can tell you, from what I understand, it's very similar to the situation in Japan. Obviously, they're two different countries with their own cultures and everything else, but there's a lot of overlap on this part of family culture and family law. And in fact, all the laws were inherited from Japan during occupation and have only received small upgrades since then. So I'm guessing that if you take the numbers for Japan and just make the appropriate ratios based on the population sizes, that the numbers would probably be similar in terms of abductions going on inside the country. Now, I think it's mostly with two Korean parents. And in fact, most hate cases so far involving Korea that I've come across have been two Korean parents where they were living in another country, and then one of them took the children back to Korea. So I think it's similar for abductions within Korea, because I don't think there's been as much international marriage as there was in Japan. That's my understanding. But the cultural aspect in the family culture, the part that's very similar is this notion that everyone is almost encouraged, often by their lawyers, to abduct first in order to establish de facto custody before the legal custody has been decided. And then that de facto situation becomes something that no one wants to overturn. And this doesn't matter about whether it's mom or dad or anything else. It's not a gender issue. It's really just about who has the children and is basically dominating them. And so that part is almost, my understanding is that's almost exactly the same situation as in Japan. And we even heard about a case of a judge in Korea who was cut off from his child for exactly the same reason. He won the custody in the divorce, but could not enforce the court order because his ex-wife had already taken the child. And I was just like, good luck with getting the bailiff to pick up the child.
Wow. So I want to go back to your personal story. And I don't think we necessarily have to go into a lot of details, because what you've done, which is really great on your website, is you've provided a very clear timeline of events of what happened pre-abduction to today with the treadmill protest. So again, I will link that in the description so people can go in and see the whole story. But I do want to ask, before the abduction, were there any signs that this was going to happen?
Looking back, there are a lot. And I think I was naive. I think the reason I was so naive, I was almost blindsided by this, and because I had been married once before, and I actually have an adult daughter from that first marriage, and that marriage didn't work out. We had plenty of problems, but once we wrapped it up, you know, we both loved our daughter and wanted her to have, you know, all she could get from both sides. And so we managed to co-parent effectively. It was not easy. Co-parenting is never easy. But it worked. You know, I'm sure it's still childhood divorce. There's plenty of, you know, trauma that my first daughter probably suffered from that. But in general, I think we both still have really good connections with her as a result. And so that was my mental frame going into it when I got married again. So I never imagined something like this. And that's why I think I didn't see those signs. And that, I guess I should have also done my homework in terms of, you know, when you're jumping into an international marriage, that there's a lot you should be thinking about. And I was more sort of rose colored glasses on that.
So my next question for you, John, would be, what would be your advice to parents anywhere in the world who might be concerned about a parental abduction to Korea?
Right. So I'll start specifically with the U.S. scenario, since that's what I know best. And in particular, one of the benefits of the fact that the State Department has listed Korea as a Hague non-compliant treaty partner is that judges in the U.S. at least will take that very seriously. So what it means is that if you're already in a in the process of divorce, at least, and your partner says, oh, I want to take the kids back to Korea for a short visit, maybe we can cool off, come up with an amicable solution or something like that. If there's any sign that that might actually be an abduction, and just asking that in the middle of the divorce process is almost itself a sign, you can ask the judge to say, no, travel to Korea is not allowed, unfortunately, because we have no way of getting the children back. So if you take them there and you refuse to come back, then the U.S. court will have lost all ability to protect the children through custody proceedings. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is that that's now a tool you can use in court when making agreements about who can travel where, is that you can point to the fact that Korea is non-compliant as a reason that the travel should not be allowed. And so that could end up with something like restrictions on passports, other kinds of restraining orders to make sure that the children don't leave the U.S. That's one thing to take into account. The harder question is, if you're not divorced yet, which is actually the scenario I found myself in, and in that case, it was Korea was not listed as non-compliant either. So at that time, everybody just thought, oh, Korea is a Hague treaty partner. You know, kids go there, they'll be guaranteed to come back if there's any problem. Well, as a result, in a situation like that, where you're just married, and then there's some signs that your partner might be thinking about abduction, it becomes a very difficult question, because if you go ahead and preemptively file for divorce as a way to start getting some court orders in place, then you're sort of escalating the situation, because maybe there was no problem, but now you've just made things worse. And also, it takes a while to get any of those kinds of court orders in place once you file for divorce. So you may not even have enough time to prevent the abduction from happening anyway. So that one is a very, very difficult situation, especially because even if, say, you have the passports held by a trusted third party or something like that, it's very easy for a Korean parent to go to a Korean consulate in the U.S. and just get new Korean passports made for the children, assuming the children are Korean citizens. So I actually don't know what the answer is in that case when you don't have divorce proceedings already going on.
I do know in the U.S. You can sign up for an alert system if an American passport, you know, is there's an application that's put in for your children. So, but that's, again, only for an American.
That's correct. Yeah, if the children don't already have U.S. passports, that's a way to prevent them from getting new U.S. passports. But as I say, if the possibly abducting parent is him or herself a Korean national, the children automatically also can get Korean passports at any time.
Absolutely. I think the compliance part is important. I think even people who, if they're not even in America, say they're European with, you know, a Korean spouse, I think even foreign courts would recognize, you know, that report by the State Department potentially and understand the risk. In some countries, I have seen parents been successfully be able to get the local immigration to stop a parent from boarding a plane with the children. There's been a recent story in Bangladesh to Japan, the mother trying to abduct the children to Japan. But that doesn't happen very often in the U.S. and Europe. Not that I've heard of.
Oh, yeah, I saw that story. That's right. Yeah, the U.S. doesn't have exit control of any kind, basically. But yes, other countries do. So that's a very good point.
And that said, what would be your advice in general to left behind parents?
So I've learned a lot, like any left behind parent, after going through this for a few years now. And on the practical side, I think the main things I learned are it's super important to listen to your lawyer, obviously, but also to have a therapist or someone in the role of therapist that's helping you at every step of the way. So if you can afford professional help for that, that's of course really good. If you can't, that can be, you know, a trusted friend or family or even a group of friends or whatever it is. But that support network is just so important for validating you at every step of the way, for acting as a confessional for the mistakes that you did make and the things that you need to address inside of yourself in order to be the best parent you can. And also just for making wise decisions at each step, separate from the legal side, but you know what's going to work best in terms of trying to communicate with the abductor, with your children when you get the chance, and really trying to take the most mature approach that you can so that you don't let the powerlessness of the situation turn into anger or other negative toxic ways of dealing with it. So I really think that is super important to have that as a resource. I wouldn't have been able to get this far without my therapist, and I'd like to thank her. And I think the second thing I want to share that I've learned is, this is more on the sort of philosophical side, is that there's a lot of ways you can frame the situation to help you survive and sometimes even thrive in difficult situations. And so I came up with a lot myself, but the one that helped me the most was thinking about the overall situation as a kind of adventure. And this might sound strange, but when the abduction starts, at least for me, everything feels absurd and meaningless. It's you know, people would ask, what's going on? Why did this happen? It's like asking, why did the tsunami come? Or why did an earthquake come? Or why did that house burn down? Or something like that. You can go into all the technical reasons and the physical reasons or whatever it is, but at the end of the day, there's often no good answer. It could be a personality disorder, or it could be, you know, the anger or desire for revenge, or all kinds of different things that could make situations like this happen. But it's not worth trying to figure that out. There is very little meaning in the abduction itself. But how you respond to the abduction is a place that you can actually create meaning in your life, and eventually that can be shown to your children too as something that you did in order to try to make a bad situation better. And so the reason I mentioned adventure is it is kind of like a quest, and you know, you're starting from a place of almost nothing when the abduction begins, and then step by step trying to collect all the items that you need on the quest, collect all the resources, go on journeys literally over oceans, finding allies who are going to help you. Sometimes it's the random little forest creature you didn't expect that's going to come and tweet a little message in your ear or something like that to help you figure out the next step. And just like when you play an RPG or something like that, you keep trying and going back to that same guy who's blocking your way, just like a government official, you keep trying, but finally you come back with the right quarter or whatever it is, and then you pass that level. And you level up and you go on and you beat the next boss or whatever it is. You don't know how the story is going to end. I don't know how the story is going to end. I don't know if I can keep this up for how long in terms of, you know, basically going through the fighting stage of just doing everything I can to try to get it resolved and moving on to, okay, I don't know what's going to happen. I just have to accept that it could be 2 years from now, 5 years from now, whatever. But in the meantime, it's very empowering to think about it as something that you are actively doing as the protagonist in a story to try to save, in my case, the prince and princess who are under a very dark enchantment right now. So I don't know if I can slay the dragon or not. I'm not even sure who the dragon is at this point, but it really helps me to think about it that way. This is something I can do every day to actually try to make the best possible outcome for this. So sometimes it can be like that, or sometimes it can be more like Alice in Wonderland or Wizard of Oz, where you're in a completely strange and basically indecipherable situation, and you just have to let the white rabbit run by and try to figure out what's going on, especially in a foreign country. It's like that all the time. But either way, you can be the protagonist of that story and you can see it through to the end.
Very, very good. Okay, great. So I think my last question for you would be kind of what message would you have to your wife and or to her family about the situation and what you, yeah, what would be your message to her?
Yeah, I think I've been asked this by a few different reporters during interviews, and my answer is always the same. It's, hey, come on, it's time to act like grownups and do what's best for our children. And that means following court orders. Grownups, adults, we follow court orders. We act responsibly. We don't take the law into our own hands. We listen to the wisdom of judges and courts and all the people that came before and crafted these laws. So please, that's what's going to have the best future for our kids. And so in this case, that means we all go back to California. We settle our remaining marital issues there, and we make sure that our children have both their parents in their lives forever.
John, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. And if you're interested in learning more about parental abduction in Korea or to Korea, or about John's story, please visit the links in the description of this podcast episode. And also, if you've been affected by abduction in or to Korea, please go ahead and reach out to us at Find My Parents so we can connect you with John.
You can be just like me.